Hello and welcome to the Eat PhD Team podcast, the podcast here to help you with your relationship with food and body by giving you evidence-based techniques to support yourself with a sprinkling of feminism, a dash of dismantling diet culture and a side of vulnerability as we share our own messy lives with you. I'm Emilia, a registered nutritionist and PhD with the sole purpose of making your life happier and healthier. If you love it, please do go wild and share it. And if you're ready for support with our coaching, details are in the show notes. Hello and welcome to episode number 298 of the Eat PhD Team podcast with myself and Holly. Hi, Holly, how are you?
I'm glorious. How are you guys doing?
Ooh, glorious.
This is what happens when I get an extra hour of sleep before the Eat PhD podcast. I go from good to glorious.
Oh, I am buzzing for you to be glorious. I'm not sure I've ever used the word glorious on this podcast, so congratulations to you. What an absolute vibe.
All I want to do is expand the vocabulary of morning greetings.
Yeah, the granularity of morning greetings have just exponentially increased. Well done, you. Anna, how are you? Come on.
Well, I'm not going to lie, I'm not feeling glorious, but I'm doing okay.
How good was that song, Glorious? I'm going to listen to that just. Well, How am I? I'm good, I think. I'm good. I am, like, at the moment, I'm in a phase, whether it be a hormonal pregnancy phase or just a life phase, where I am very much, like, determined to just organize and get things going and get but I still also have the and I have decent energy. Like, my brain works after 6 p.m at the moment some nights, which is fantastic, which is ideal since we run like binge breakthrough calls and things at 6 p.m always good to be awake. But so I'm really like, I'm going for it, and then by Thursday afternoon, Friday, I'm kind of a little bit like pushed it a little bit too far this week, and then I repeat the cycle every Sunday to Thursday. I'm like, this is it. But it feels very productive. Definitely not like...
Sounds ideal.
Yeah, it's not avoidance or anything like that. It's just purely productivity. So yeah, it's also glorious.
I feel like my brain stops working after 6 p.m. just on a daily basis, and general, I don't have any kind of excuses for that. Just just shuts down.
Yeah. I mean, that's a sign, I'm sure, of being productive through the day. Let's go with that.
Yes, that's definitely it.
Has anybody got anything, any exciting news or seen anything this week?
I wish that I had something that immediately came to my mind that I thought was super exciting. I baked some purple bread this week.
Oh, I didn't see that. I'm assuming that was on your show.
You know why you didn't see it? It's because it looks cool. I'm going to remake it. But I my husband got me a stand mixer after he watched my last croissant debacle where I did it by hand. Oh, yeah. And it was great. And I made them with the stand mixer and life was good. And I was like, what else can I make with this stand mixer? It's going to be everything. So I thought, make my sourdough in a stand mixer. I don't know if anyone out there can make it work, but mine didn't come out all like spongy and fluffy like it normally does. It's more of like a purple pancake, but it tastes pretty good. So the purple color was exciting. The rest was less successful, but I'm excited about the purple bread and I'm going to make more purple items.
Right. What is the purple?
Beetroot? It's ube extract.
Oh.
Yeah.
And can you taste it?
It depends how much you put in. I wanted to taste it, so I put in enough that you can. I'm a big fan of like ube and pandan, which is like the Asian version of vanilla, but it's green. So you can make really cool colors with ube and pandan.
Nice. I remember back in my really horrible disordered alkaline days, that reminds me, I swear I used to make something like, I would eat purple sweet potatoes and I think I made some sort of like purple pancake with something, because you know it's alkaline, so healthy. It's bringing back some sort of not nice memories.
It's interesting because my sweet potato phase was the paleo phase. Uh-huh. Which was like, there was a big phase in the early days of CrossFit where like everyone was trying to do like zone and paleo like together. It was
I remember that.
I wouldn't go back to that time.
Well, I remember that because at the time, Anna, you might have been the same, like I was bodybuilding, so you know I was looking at these peasants doing paleo like, oh, them with their restricted
diet.
It was
diet. Me, I was the peasant.
Yeah. I was gonna say, you've seen my old diet plan.
Oh, you've seen Yeah, but then it's like, okay, let's look at this really great bodybuilding. Because of course, remember back in the day, it's like, oh, bodybuilding hates CrossFit. CrossFit thinks bodybuilding is
Yeah.
stupid. And then I would just and then but I would be like sat there with like my very specific macroed food and like still eating sweet potato rather than white potato. And I'm like, oh, how foolish of them. Whilst I'm over there like, yeah, this is great. I'm so healthy right now. Did I look
What I
great?
got on my explore page,
Oh
you
no.
know, I was well, I was educating Roz on what it is, but protein, was it protein fluff? Do you remember that? And
What was that again?
it was like whey and xanthan gum,
Oh my
and like
God,
if you
yeah.
want, yeah,
That made you
in
get the shits if you ate too much of it. I remember
yeah,
that. And I would be
yeah.
like, oh, it's bloating me, so it's managing my hunger. Again, it's extremely disordered. This is not us encouraging this at all. But I'd be like, oh yeah, if I eat two of these protein fluffs, like I just feel like my stomach's going to blow up because there's so much xanthan gum in it. So this is a really good diet hack. It's so disturbing when you think back to the way that your mind used to work.
Yeah, but the fact that it's doing the rounds again, I was like, oh no, I thought we were through this.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was like a some sort of flashback, whatever it's called on your Instagram.
Oh no. This was new, fresh on my explore page. I was like, oh guys, no,
Well,
your poor tummy.
that's upsetting. Can you imagine going back to like diet hack foods now? Not the like, look, there's for sure if you're on a fat loss journey, there are certain things that are going to make dieting easier, right? For sure. But can you imagine going back to like all the things that you used to genuinely believe were nice back in the day, like sugar-free jellies or like protein fluff or I never thought that spunk pasta tasted nice, but like that kind of spunk pasta, like you know the stuff that I mean. Well, imagine having like this such a varied palate and then going back to that now.
No, couldn't
No
do it.
thanks. No thanks. Each to their own, but not for us. Okay. We lost, I did say this in the EIQ podcast yesterday, actually, but we did lose another person to that we love to glucose monitoring this week. So that was sad. You put it in, I think you put it in the chat, or someone did. Sad. It's really, glucose monitoring is not dying out. It's really not.
It's one of those things that I feel like now is the big wave. Like I remember having sort of biohacky friends who were like super into it, I don't know, 3, 4 years ago or something. And they were into it from like a, you know, data perspective. They're like the data people. And I was like, oh yeah, cool. I can see how data people would be like quantified self. And then they were like the early adopters. And now it's in this wave where it's been like mass marketed. And it's, I mean, you see that progression with so many of these like initially niche health trends that then sort of blow up. Yeah, it's I get a lot of questions about glucose monitoring as a result of that.
I remember bodybuilders used to do it. I mean, I'm sure they still do, but I used to get asked questions about it at the time, especially when we were more in the bodybuilding space. And it's like, well, they're doing it because they're injecting insulin. Like, it might actually be relatively smart for them to just check what things are going on for them. They're injecting something exogenous into their bodies, but that's not. But of course, they don't say that's why. Obviously,
Yes.
just the
Epitome of health there.
That's what we need to do too. Go on a meal plan
You know
and
what I did see this morning, actually, and I haven't listened to the episode, but there might be someone credible going on the podcast that notoriously doesn't have
oh,
brilliant health.
great. Great.
I saw Lane Norton, a
Oh
clip
yeah,
of
I
him.
did see that. I did see that. I saw the clip that they shared of him crying. And I thought,
Yeah, I did see that, but I was like,
oh.
well, I kind of want to know, but also, yay, yay that you've got someone that I quite like on there.
Yeah, you listen. I thought today, I don't need Lane Norton crying in my face. I'm going to just come off this now. But good to
Haven't been on the social media enough this morning yet to have
clearly.
come across it, but I'm sure I will later in my
Clearly.
scrolling.
You're in for a treat, my friend. But yes,
Can't
it is
wait.
good. At least he's evidence-based. Okay, let's get started on questions. Anna, do you want to go first?
Sure thing. I've just started a new job and I don't really have a set of tasks or roles to do yet. How to stop thinking about food? So this person is in their first week of coaching also.
Reminds me of when I started. So I had like an interim job between like my PhD and lecturing. It's called like program support tutor. Basically, what that was like support for the students, but also pick up literally any lecture that other people don't want to do. So I feel like it required far more skill than actually being a lecturer and knowing what you're going into. But I was just about to do my first show. I was like just starting my first prep at the same time, and I just started the job, and I started early because they forgot to give me the right date. So I was there a month early, so they didn't set anything up for me, and I was going into work, maybe 6-pack bag, like honestly, and just hungry all the time and with nothing to do, and just sat in the office, and it was miserable. To say that I created a list, and I just moved to Manchester at the time too. So by the time I competed that time, it's obviously my first show too, I had just like an entire list of places I wanted to eat in Manchester, all the places around me, like around the uni that I knew that I was going to go for lunch that day and things like that. By the time like 2 months later, because it was just the food preoccupation was just wild. I obviously handled it like a pro back in the day. So don't do as I do. Do as I say, if you want. But what, like, I would ask, like, is there something that I can be doing, like, that's maybe not in my normal job role, that's a bit more menial, that I can feel like I can support with, because I want to make sure that I'm making the best use of my time. I think that would probably be a good use of your time. If they say no, then what would you spend your time doing at home other than watching TV? Like, do you have an audiobook? Do you like to read things online that are nothing to do with food or fitness? Do you like blogs, etc.? I would start filling my time with other things. Obviously, over time, your food preoccupation will come down because Anna's going to work with you on terms of like restriction and why you're preoccupied, etc., etc. But I would just mean like short-term interim stuff. I think that would probably be the approach I would take.
Yeah, I think just giving yourself some kind of structure basically to your day, right? Is if there's no structure provided, create it for yourself. And then, as Amelia said, it's going to be basically if you're finding that that's what comes up for you when you don't have something else to do, then it's addressing the underlying reasons for that being there, whether that be related with food stuff or be, yeah, any physical or mental restriction stuff. So, yeah, I'm sure you'll be working with that with Anna as you move through your coaching.
Nothing worse than being bored at work. Like, I don't mean like hating your job, like we've all got parts of our job that we don't like, etc., but like that feeling of like waiting for something to do, I don't miss that feeling as much as sometimes I'm like, God, I don't know how to do all of this stuff. As much as sometimes I'm like that, I like that feeling of just waiting for things to do, especially when you first start a job and you just feel like you just don't want to ask people questions and you just feel a little bit awkward, but it'll pass very fast. And you'll be thriving in your job in no time, I'm sure. Well, I'm not sure because I don't know who you are. I'm assuming you're great because you're here. Okay, Holly, question.
I'm frustrated at myself for going back into this unhelpful cycle after feeling so on top of my habits and being mindful of my behaviors. Is there a common cycle you see with clients?
I was waiting because I was like, she looks like she's going to say something. She looks like she's going to say something.
Well,
Staring at you.
I mean, I think it's on. I appreciate the frustration, but it's kind of unhelpful. Like, I mean, what do we always say? Like, meet yourself with compassion, because these things happen. But I'd get curious and explore. Okay, like, because it does. Like, we go back to what feels comfortable, what feels safe, what feels familiar, and has there been something that has come up that's caused you to lean on these behaviors again? And if so, what plans do you need to put in place to support yourself a bit better, or in a way that kind of you know aligns with your goals and your values?
I don't know about you two, but I don't know if I've ever worked with someone ever that has moved through overeating or binge eating or the struggles that they have with their relationship with food once, kind of quote unquote stopped, and then never done it again. I don't think I've, and I include myself in this, by the way. There's a reason that I will often talk about how intentional I still am with eating regularly. Eating mindfully, meh, on the whole, try. And the things that support me. there is a reason why I do that, because I know that if I'm not intentional with these things, there is a chance and there is a likelihood that I may well overeat. And that's happened at phases of my life, you know, in the last couple of years for whatever reason. Because again, it feels comfortable. It's my known habit loop. It's my known response to certain stimuli. So yeah, it's not that I want to say, oh, it doesn't matter, because obviously you want to learn from it, but it's not you. It's, I suppose, what I want to say.
Yeah, I often tell people like I'm almost more worried if we like start working together and it quote unquote never comes up again, at least whilst we're working together, because then I almost feel like, oh, have we just stuck a band-aid over the, that was very American of me, have we stuck a plaster over the
Doesn't mean they
the
have the
issue
same
with,
effect. Like,
oh, it's temporary.
yeah.
Yeah, have we stuck a band-aid over the issue with like the external accountability of coaching, right? And what's going to happen then when we take that off at the end of your time with us working together? So it's really common that we see this, and it's a really a normal part of the cycle. Even if you look at like the stages of change model, which is sometimes how we think about behavior change, like lapse or relapse is built into that model, and then it's more about how we come back from that, exactly what Anna said, meeting ourselves with compassion and building the skill of resilience, because there's going to be times where we use unhelpful behaviors again. And it's going to be more about how we talk to ourselves and how swiftly we can move back into our helpful behavior patterns. I also think that, like, I'm writing a post on this morning, which is why it's top of my mind. But from a brain perspective, like, our window of tolerance, so like the amount of stress fluctuation we can take, we'll grow that during coaching, right? It'll get bigger and we'll be able to take more like high stress and like lower arousal than we might have been able to in the past. But every now and again, there's gonna be some combo of stressors or like some big emotional stressor that comes up that is just beyond that window that we've developed, like our ability to tolerate that stress fluctuation. And when that happens, the bit of our brain that's like storing our new habits that we used to like purposefully bring those in those times is inhibited. It's harder for us to access that. And our like sort of stress and habit circuits are way more active. So we're much more likely to end up falling into those old behaviors when something like that comes up. It's going to be, that's like a normal neurological process, unfortunately. But as you ingrain those new habits over time, you're going to be able to take more and more fluctuations without losing those new habits. Although, as Amelia said, every now and again, like even for us now, years later, we're still really intentional with it, because there will be times where something still comes up that we're like, oh, that was unexpected, but there it is. And now I go back to normal.
Yeah, I like the what if it happens for me, I'm like, oh, that's interesting. And I'll usually say it out loud. Like sometimes if I'm like on body checking more for some reason, or I overeat or something, I'm like, oh, interesting. And then it just immediately takes off the guilt, the shame, the self-criticism of like, and it moves your brain towards, oh, I wonder why that happened. And it's not a judgment. It's just like, oh, okay, it happened because actually I didn't eat all day yesterday, or because my world is just turned upside down, or whatever it is, and you can just get a bit more curious about it. You will get to the point where you sometimes overeat, and you're like, and you do that, or you go, oh, give yourself a break, like that happened. You will get to that point, and it won't be a big deal. Okay, if you're acne prone, does whey protein increase the amount of acne that you're seeing? There's so much opposing information on this online.
I would check out, it's Anjali, isn't it? I don't know how you say her surname, so I'm not going to attempt to to try and say it, but she puts out some fantastic evidence-based research, and I'm pretty sure I read about dairy and about acne, because it is a very common thing. And I think a lot of people, it's one of those, I think it's one of those things that people like, oh, I'll cut out dairy to look at, like to sort my skin out. But then you're also probably having a lot more fruit and veg and getting outside and doing your skincare and properly hydrated. And it's not necessarily the dairy. And I think I'm pretty sure that's what I read on Anjali's thing, is that it's not the dairy that's causing it. It's like the other factors.
Anjali
So,
said, oh, sorry.
sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, she said to me at Women's Health Live, this was years ago, we were talking about it, and she said, you know, I get a lot of people come to me in clinic saying about whey protein and acne, and there are some links for some people, but the evidence that we do have that made that link was like 14-year-old boys or something, wasn't it? Holly, you might know this. But it was like young boys, and there was a link potentially between dairy, not whey protein, and acne, but there haven't been those links in adult women, for example. But she was saying that most of the time it's because people don't, she said, I see it a lot in gym people when they're increasing their whey protein and things. And she said, most of the time it's because they don't immediately shower after the gym. It's actually much more related to the fact they're sitting in sweaty clothes for hours at a time, and the bacteria in the gym and these types of things, rather than the whey protein. It's just, again, it's like we love to scapegoat foods, right? Oh, food will fix it. So let's just cut it. Whey protein must be that because it's ultra processed and steroids and whatever else people say.
Yeah, I mean, we can't say it's not. Like, for that particular person, the only way you would know would be to keep everything else in your life exactly the same and take out the whey protein and run that experiment and then add it back in different amounts over a certain amount of time. If you don't want to go into that much effort, which is valid, then I mean, you get the choice of whether you want to take whey protein or a different protein source and see if that makes any difference. But yeah, on the whole, from an evidence-based perspective, the evidence is like not super strong for that. I was going to say, especially in female population, but of course also it's just been studied less in
Yeah.
a female population, so it's tricky for us to say for sure.
I would say this person too has just been traveling and for a while and in different climates, very different climates actually, and long plane journeys, and been through quite a stressful situation. So it's more likely, not impossible, especially because this person I know has had whey protein for a long time. More likely to be
Okay.
something else.
Yeah, nothing kills your skin like being in a flying tube for like 10 hours. It's
Yeah.
terrible.
Need to get those Dr. Jart face masks. I'm telling you, if you they're they may they make you look like Hannibal Lecter, but the hyaluronic acid, like very strong ones, are great. I actually discovered this website that I'm going to share with everyone right now. I'm just going to get it up on my phone. I just want to double check what it's called. Whatsinmyjar.com. It's called What's in My
What's
Jar,
in my jar? Okay.
and it's evidence-based skincare. From what I can tell, what they do is basically any product, you search for the product and it breaks down. It's not the full evidence base that they have, but they'll break it down in terms of, okay, this face mask says it does X, Y, and Z. This is the strength of evidence we have for each part, and then it gives you like a rating out of 100 in terms of evidence base. Dr. Jart blue masks came out, I think they were 100 for moisturizing, and so highly recommend those. I feel comfortable. Again, this is not my evidence, I don't know, but from my research, would recommend those if you're in a plane.
I like that. Sounds like the examine.com for
For
skincare.
skincare. Exactly. It's not as thorough, but it's pretty good. So highly recommend.
Take it.
Anna.
TMI warning and possibly not relevant, but I've decided it is relevant. So I'm probably going to say this wrong, vulvodynia, dynia.
Vulvodynia, yeah.
And haven't been able to have penetrative sex with my boyfriend for 18 months. As gentle as he is, most of the touch is painful. As a result, I feel like a huge part of our relationship is on hold as the sexual part of myself feels switched off. Because I anticipate pain, I just can't bring myself to try other things. And I hold back from kisses and cuddles in case it leads to more, in case I can't carry on. If I do experience pain, I end up getting upset, which is a massive mood killer, and I just feel broken and faulty. How can I reduce this feeling and the guilt that comes with it and learn to be comfortable in exploring other ways of being with my partner?
Oh. I would recommend a book that will give you way more than what's going to come out of my mouth, at least. And the book is called Come As You Are. I haven't read the full thing. I've read chapters of it, but then I think that there was some crossover with something else, so I didn't read the full thing. But it's a very good book. And I don't know the author, if she's like a, if she's a sex therapist or if she's a doc. I feel like she's a doctor, like a PhD doctor, I think. And so I would recommend that you know, get lost in that book, and that will give you some insight, and I think probably some tools. I, for a completely different reason, I had an experience with a partner where we were working on intimacy and not without with no sex, and it was the best intimacy that we ever had in our relationship, and it was because there was zero pressure for it to go anywhere else, so it was actually really, really enjoyable. And I wonder if, like, because it that there's nothing quote unquote wrong with that, and I just wonder if you're stopping yourself from enjoying that part that can create intimacy because you feel this sense of guilt and the sense of shame. And both of those, of course, are like, I understand, but they're you don't deserve to feel those things. They're not like a, yeah, you don't deserve to feel those feelings in response to that. If therapy was accessible for you, I would really recommend a therapist, especially one who specializes in this area, and talking it through, because I don't know the ins and outs in terms of vulvodynia, but I feel like there is a large psychological component, but I really don't want to overstep here, so I don't 100% know. But I would, again, self-compassion here is probably really helpful. And I wonder if you've explored like masturbation or self-intimacy, and it doesn't have to look like that. It could look like connecting with yourself in the bath, like just doing body scans, noticing like this feeling of touch on yourself, on your legs, on your arms. It doesn't have to be a sexual thing. I wonder if you could explore that side of things initially, before then exploring it with your partner. But again, that would be, that's just kind of my ideas. I haven't worked with a client in this situation before, and it's obviously outside my scope in that sense.
Yeah, I wouldn't have much to add to that. I also feel like a bit outside of my scope, but it would just be like looking at the shoulds that you have around it. The same thing that we do with a lot of body image and nutrition work, looking at the shoulds around it. Also, common humanity, I think, can be really helpful in anything that's bringing up a lot of guilt and shame. So looking for like support groups, or I know for sure there will be podcasts like on this topic that might be really helpful and also help you feel less alone in that.
I'm going to do a shameless plug and say, listen to my, I think it's episode 6 of my podcast, because I talk about that. Because I've had, again, not with this particular condition, but women with endometriosis and pelvic pain and similar feelings, in that because they're anticipating the pain, they just avoid it and shut off entirely. And I'm not going to lie, I'd rather play dead at times because I've been so tired than do anything. And I think getting to know that part of you and making peace with that part of you and going, do you know what? It's perfectly okay if I don't want to, like Amelia was saying, taking that pressure off, because we always think intimacy is going to lead to sex. And actually, you can do loads of things with your partner that, well, they don't even need to be in the bedroom, like even just going out for a walk and doing puzzles together. And like sometimes it can be really helpful in like planning it in. So again, you're preparing yourself, you can switch off, try and switch off that stress, and that anticipation of something's going to happen. And again, if this is accessible, like what about a couple's massage? Because again, you're doing it together, but there's, well, unless you go to somewhere, I don't know, then it's not going to lead to anything more. But you get that sense of intimacy from doing things together. And I would just take it really slow.
I always wonder how couples' massages are intimate, because I always think, if when I'm getting a massage and my head's in a hole and I'm focusing on the person's hands on my back or wherever, I mean, I don't mean wherever, like they could be somewhere else, I just mean like on my legs. I always see like couples' massages on things, and I'm like, I don't know. I feel like I forget they were there. It's like about me. I also wanted to be about me, so that's maybe why. But I don't really get the old intimacy part.
Do you know what? I've booked myself a spa day as like an incentive to finish this bit of work that I'm trying to do. And I was like, no, I want to go on my own. Please don't come with me. Like, this is my time.
Feel like that's my go-to as well. May say something about us. Okay, Holly,
Rude.
question.
Okay. Do all the habits we practice with ETPHD, breath work, mindfulness, hunger scales, etc., truly start to become an ingrained habit eventually? Sometimes my black and white thinking surrounding them makes it difficult to be consistent, as I either seem to be doing all of them or none of them.
Sorry, go on, you go.
No, not all of them are going to become the most ingrained things that like that are values aligned and make sense to you and forevermore just become a thing for you to do. And probably not. There are some things like journaling, let's say. For me, I'll do it if I have to do it. I know it's time to do it, basically. But it's not, but that for me doesn't resonate hugely with me. I work with people who don't like meditation. You know, they're weird, but no, can but they don't necessarily love to do that. But what is ingrained for them is journaling, is taking like a walk in silence, some sensory deprivation, whatever it may be. These things feel ingrained to them. I think I want to remove the idea that you're never going to be have to be intentional with something again, because that's life. Like, unfortunately, most of the things that require Most things that offer some sort of reward to us require work, but if these things, if you can understand for yourself how these align with your values, it makes it a lot easier to naturally choose to do these things or want to do these things, even if it doesn't necessarily feel like an instinctual choice or an instinct rather. But then something we've spoken about before is like the hierarchy of competence of initially when you may start like at the bottom of a pyramid, which is like unconscious. This is where I mess it up. Unconscious competence on the bottom, right? And then you become consciously aware, unconscious incompetence. Then you become conscious that you're incompetent, right? So you start to realize, oh, I'm not doing something, quote unquote, the way that I want to do it or in the most optimal way. And then you become consciously competent. So you start to do these things consciously. So you're intentionally doing breath work, you're intentionally doing mindfulness, you're intentionally eating regularly, all of these things. And at the top of the pyramid is unconscious competence. So these things are much more intuitive and they require less intention day to day. We don't think every day, like, okay, I'm going to eat regularly every day. That means I'm going to eat at this time, this time, this time. And then I'm going to do my meditation and we're ticking up. Once you've been doing it, you know, people who leave ETPHD generally are not, still don't need the need to find the need to be accountable to the habits. Because they're in this place where intuitively they know these things are supportive for them. So there is a bit of trust in the process and yourself that you will be again to, that you will continue rather to move through this. Because think back to a year ago, you might not have even known about these things. You might not have even known that your overeating was an issue for you. You might have just been going about day to day and mindless overeating. And not really thinking about, like, not really thinking about it. And you've already moved, like, you know, you've already moved through that. And so you'll continue to progress up that hierarchy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer is basically like some of them might become ingrained, but if you put the pressure on yourself from the beginning that like all of them must become ingrained for you to be this like perfect enlightened human, then you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot from the get-go, because that pressure is going to make you so resistant to doing them. One thing that I think I've spoken about this before around workouts probably on the podcast, but one thing I do with people where they have this really like all or nothing mentality around things like breath work or meditation or journaling or whatever is to be inconsistent on purpose, if that makes sense. So like I find really often people are like, oh, time to get my like 30-day meditation streak. And I'm like, what if we on purpose don't do a 30-day meditation streak and we do it for like 2 days next week, and then you don't do it for the rest of the week. And then the next day maybe we go for 5 days. and the next thing we do like one day, and you get this different version of those habits when you allow yourself to on purpose sometimes not do it. And we just observe the difference between the experiences on the days where you do it and the days surrounding that, and the days you don't do it and the days surrounding that. And then it starts to become this thing where you go, oh, cool, like if I want to feel this way, I'll do that thing at this frequency, and I can vary that depending how I feel on a week-to-week basis. I find if we get into this thing of like, it needs to be meditation 3 times a week every week, then as soon as you do 2 times, you're like, well, screw that. That didn't work. So allowing yourself to be more flexible with it. And like, if we're really all or nothing people, I am too, like making that flexibility for yourself, so that you do it, because otherwise it can be really easy to like slip into a very rigid mindset around any of these habits, and that makes them harder to stick to in the long run.
Got distracted at the end there by the tail in the background.
I
I was
saw a
like,
little
what?
tail flicking around there too.
He's just making himself a nest. Like,
I mean, why not? It's
Oh,
pretty
vibes. Yeah, I might do that after this too.
Okay, I'm frustrated at myself for going back into this. Oh wait, sorry, do on there. Sorry, moving on. Don't mind me. I have done a lot of work on eating for satiety, eating mindfully, and ensuring I have 3 meals and 2 snacks. I now eat in a way that is aligned to my values. How do I move on to fat loss? I understand it's a gradual process, but I just don't see how I will ever get there.
I think people often have this fear that everything's going to change when the goal changes. And I will say this to anyone on a discovery call, that the way in which we coach is a way for life, and the goal might change throughout, but the fundamentals are all there. And you've done incredible work to set you up in a really good place to move into fat loss, and I'm gonna guess you've got a good understanding, like you eat to satiety. I'm gonna guess you've got a good understanding of hunger, fullness, and the meal regularity side of things doesn't need to change. The food choices might change a little bit, but if we think in terms of, and you might have worked through this resource with your coach, you might not, it might be something you explore, but the body food choice congruence is going to be one that's really important when it comes to focusing on how you can keep that satiety with meals, even when dieting. Like, are there particular balance of is there a particular balance of macros? Like, do you work best with predominantly fats and proteins at meals? Okay, how can we make that work in a more fat loss focus? Or like, I need a crunch in my meal, and it doesn't matter to me whether the crunch comes from tortilla chips or carrot sticks, like as long as I've got some crunch. But one of those is going to be more aligned to fat loss goals. And it's just continuing now to eat in a way that really works for you, even though the goal is switched.
Yeah, I think a lot of people that I take through that process and going to like start thinking about going into a fat loss phase, or even when we move into it, they're kind of like, oh, why is it so less hard than last time? There's a lot of worry of like, should I be doing more things? Like, shouldn't this feel more extreme? But like, everything's working. And it's when it takes a little while of being in that to go, oh no, it can be like this. It's not actually going to be that different if you've done that foundational work ahead of time. Again, like I've mentioned this before on the podcast too, but often I'll have people write down what their specific worries are, in terms of approaching a fat loss phase. Like, what's bringing up any, like, what are you worried about losing? Like, what are you worried about potentially, like, quote unquote, going backwards in, or what are you concerned about in terms of changes that you think you're going to need to make entering a fat loss phase, so that we can address those ahead of time and have a game plan for those in case they come up. Or just sometimes by writing them down, we go, oh, actually, I know that I'm not going to need to do that, or I know that I've got a different attitude towards that than I might have had in the past. And also, like, you don't, even if you like try it out and don't like it, you don't ever have to go into a fat loss phase. Like, it, even if you came into like relationship with food coaching with the aim of fat loss at the end of that, if you go through that process and you're like, actually, I feel awesome, you're totally allowed to make the choice to not pursue fat loss after that too.
Yeah, it's always interesting when that happens because some people sometimes are like, yep, I realize I don't want to do it. And then other people sometimes feel like they're kind of attached to it in some way because they've committed. It's like the sunk cost thing of like, oh, well, I've committed now. But it's great to know what's right for you. I think like there's an important narrative around fat loss in that it's not just a calorie deficit, right? That was an important conversation to have in fitness wellness space, right? For sure. However, when it comes to if you've done all of this work on things and your relationship with food, you have this knowledge, I am inclined to say that's the only thing that's changing is your calorie intake. Like nothing else really has to change. And your training's not going to change. You might be more intentional with like, I don't know, you might increase your step count a little bit if that works for you. Like, but that stuff doesn't really have to change. Your mindfulness doesn't change. Your regularity of eating doesn't have to change. So like Anna was saying, like some of your food choices might change. You might sit with hunger for a little bit longer, not eat to like fullness for every meal, potentially. Again, everyone's different with this, but it is just the only thing that really has to change is your calorie intake or your calorie, your energy balance. So I'm just trying to, I don't want it to be reductionist for most people. Like, obviously, there's lots of reasons why that's a challenge, but with where you're at, try not to inflate it into something bigger than it needs to be. Anna.
Any advice for finding time to ground when away for a weekend hen do that you've had to organize? I'm quite a people person, but I do also like my own peace and quiet and moments of stillness to reconnect. Any tips?
Any of you organise a hen weekend or a bachelorette weekend?
I used to organize retreats, so it's not the same party vibes, I guess, but I have organized groups of adult females mainly to a different country and like coordinated them in that place. And from my experiences of that, things I did sort of like accidentally that then was really glad I did was things like booking separate well, we booked big houses, so I booked separate accommodation because the rooms got full. And then I was like, wow, I'm so glad that I accidentally, the first time I did it, booked separate accommodation, and then I kept doing that most of the times after that too. And also like planning in, if you're planning the schedule, planning in chunks of time where there's not activities the entire time. Like the fact that you want alone time and downtime, I guarantee you other people are hoping the same thing and needing the same thing, and no one's gonna be pissed off if there's like a 3 hour break in the middle of the day one day where people can like take a nap or like read a book for a while or whatever. So I definitely, like, the first couple of times I planned those, like, filled way too much time. And then I was exhausted. The feedback from other people was also like, oh, we'd kind of like actually some unstructured time. So I think not feeling like you, when you're planning something like that, that you have to be responsible for what people are doing every hour of every day. Like, actually, people like to have some time to just riff.
Do I order organized way back in the day my best friend's hen, the second one, because you know this was in the days where, and I don't know if people still do this, but they would have two hen weekends. So the first one was in Magaluf. I couldn't go because I couldn't afford it. I was doing my PhD and I had no money. And then the second one I was like, I can't go, and I was a bridesmaid and I felt really guilty that I couldn't go, but I physically was like, I couldn't afford to eat. So I was like, I'll organize the home one. And it was Saturday night, and I was competing the following Saturday or Sunday. So I was very lean, very tired, and sober. And it was pub golf, and it was pub golf in our hometown, and it's a small town. And I was like, I'm not gonna, like, I'm gonna show up as a great best friend. And this was before, like, I definitely had even less confidence and I was even more introverted and shy. I was like, I'm gonna, like, I need to be on it. And I remember on the night, a girl said to me, oh, there was another girl who was sober who's really extrovert. She's a dancer. And she's like, really just, she's so fun. And the girl said to me, oh, you can't tell that she's sober, but you can tell that you're sober. I could tell that you weren't drinking. And I remember being like, the whole night is ruined. I'm trying so hard to be fun and I'm still not fun enough because I'm sober. Stupid competing. That is my experience of unorganized hen, and I hated it. I hated it. And not, and it wasn't my best friend's fault. I just wanted to be to do my best for my best friend, and I didn't, for lots of reasons. So I feel for you. I hope yours is going better than that. And even if you just grab like 2 minutes, go to the bathroom and just, no one's going to miss you for, no offense, but like for 2 minutes, for 5 minutes, where you just go outside to be like, just get a breath, getting a breath. And also feel, I hope that you feel a little bit empowered to be able to say, I'm just going outside for 5 minutes, and not feel like you have to explain yourself of why. Like, you don't need to justify the fact that you're a human being and you would like 5 minutes on your own time. It doesn't have to be this big deal.
Yeah, I don't have much to add. I think it is just having, mean, I guess removing the pressure that you need to be there and show up and, for everyone all of the time. And it's not selfish to take that time out for yourself. And I guess remove the idea that it needs to be maybe. I know this client loves journaling. Loves meditation, but like you were saying, immediately it might just be okay. I'm gonna have a few breaths outside for a couple of minutes and then go back and join the group, or I'm gonna go to the toilet and have again just a couple of moments to myself. But just yeah, do what you need to do for you, because then you'll show up better for them as well.
Yeah, it's the same as like events and stuff. Like, if I'm doing an event all weekend, I'll just disappear outside on my own for a while, and I'm just like, yeah, I'm fine, because you're just smiling all day, and you're like, I can't smile anymore. I need to go and be miserable outside for 5 minutes, and then I can come back in and smile again. But just be okay with it. Just be okay with it. That's the answer. It's fine.
Solved.
Yeah, should have just said that in the first place. Okay, Holly, last question, I think.
Okay. I wonder if you've ever tried EFT or tapping before, and if so, what your thoughts are.
So I feel like I shared this with you, did I, Amelia?
But you did it because you asked me.
A client had mentioned that she'd been doing it, and I was giving it a whirl, and I quite like it, I have to say. I find it ever so soothing. I think, well, I know I've spoken before about, like, I love the, like, butterfly hooks, butterfly tapping. And for me, I think it's like a mix of maybe rhythm and touch, I don't know. But
None of
yeah.
which I have in my life, sadly.
Well, oh no, I have no rhythm.
Yeah, I have nothing to say on that because I don't know. But what I was going to say is, every time Anna talks, the baby kicks. It kicked the first time ever when we were on a podcast together. But I was just noticing it there, and it's been, I say he, that's just my knee jerk. It's not anything. I'm not giving anything away. But whenever you've talked on this podcast, he's like, oh, hi. I need to say it again.
Best friends already.
I know. Do you know anything about it, Holly?
I personally, I don't, I like, I'm like a, this makes sense with jiu-jitsu too, but I'm like a heavy, constant pressure kind of person. I don't like, and same with my massages, I like them to be like heavy, constant pressure. I don't like light, like, feelings on me. I never have. So for me, I have clients who really like it. It's not a personal thing that I enjoy doing, and I don't like anything which is like light tapping things. I'm like ho like heavy hugs and stuff, weighted blankets, like that's my kind of vibe, like just squash me.
Yeah, I am that. I am so the same. I was reading my hypnobirthing book, and it kind of takes you through like different things your birth partner can do, and some of them are a bit quite obscure in terms of like the hold up your hand and then drop it again. I'm not sure what the purpose of that was. To be honest, I skimmed through quite a lot of them because one of them was light touch, like arm strokes. And as I was reading it, I was like dry heaving of. I cannot imagine anything more infuriating when I am in labor than someone lightly touching my arm and moving their fingers. Piss right off. I will get so angry. So then they're like, oh, this can be really. No, I'm with you. I couldn't. I would much rather you just gave me a weighted blanket and put that over me than try to touch
Just
my
over your face,
arm.
just.
Yeah, just over my whole body, cocoon me and leave me alone. That will be my birth plan. Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm the same. I'm exactly the same. I find it really infuriating. I've never tried tapping, so maybe I won't. Okay, thank you so much for the question. Thank you both so much. Bye.
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 Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And as always, if you did, please do feel free to like, share, subscribe, and review. And if you would like to chat to me, then you can find details of my Instagram in the show notes.